The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. My name is Gary Kramer, and I'm a freelance writer for Salon.com, among other publications. It's a pleasure for me to introduce David Daly tonight. Tonight, we are going to get rat-fucked. But don't worry, I can say that word. Andy assured me that this is a First Amendment shop. Rat-fucked is the title of David Daly's book. He uses the term, which means political sabotage, at least 6 times in the first chapter. I lost count of how many times thereafter. Daly was, until recently, the editor-in-chief at Salon.com. His book looks at the serious issue of gerrymandering and how redistricting maps have allowed Republicans to grab and maintain power in key states, including Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Wisconsin. He writes calmly, but with righteous outrage, about the redistricting majority project, known by the appropriate acronym Red Map. Daly describes the work of Chris Jankowski, the Republican State Leadership Committee, and a small group of really smart strategists with brilliant plans to triple gerrymander courts, state houses, and congressional lines, legally, if unethically. Ratfucked also provides a cogent analysis of how the outcome of gerrymandering has an enormous impact on our political system. Daly cagily observes that Maptitude, the software that allows politicians to redraw and redistrict maps to their advantage, quote, may be the best political video game ever. Carving out lines is as easy as selecting a fantasy football team. Ratfucked is full of such candor and insight that anyone who has read Daly's work on Salon has come to know. His vivid writing describes how Michigan's 8th and 11th congressional districts, quote, candy swirl around Pontiac like a summer camp art project. And he passionately explains the importance of why minorities remain grossly underrepresented in Congress, state legislatures, local boards, and commissions. He shows the disservice gerrymandering has on voters and residents who are systematically denied representation by their parties and who often have the majority vote but a minority in Congress. Daly's book reads like a thriller as he explains how Republicans use, quote, that fucking $600 million Arlen Specter library to their advantage, undoing, or rat-fucking, Pennsylvania Democrat David Livdansky in the process. He uncovers secret emails by the Ohio Campaign for Accountable Redistricting, or, in my favorite case, the audacious power grab in Florida, where a series of intriguing emails by Alex Bassotto exposed the chicanery afoot in that state. But you will learn more about these fascinating episodes from the author. Please join me in welcoming David Daly and his book, Ratfucked.
Good evening. Thank you for coming. There might not be a better state in America to talk about the impact of gerrymandering and redistricting, let alone in this city whose history is so filled with democratic ideals. This book started with a really simple question. I wanted to understand how Barack Obama could be reelected president in 2012 with a solid electoral college majority of 332-206, a popular vote majority of 5 million, but nevertheless barely budge the House of Representatives. The Democrats won 25 of 33 Senate seats that fall and did gain 8 seats in the House, but that only trimmed the Republican majority to 234-201. The House would continue to lead the obstruction to the president's policies, frustrating liberals who saw their tactics as obstructionist. A government shutdown ensued, as did dozens of votes on an Obamacare repeal. More time spent examining Benghazi than a Libya policy which turned that country into a hellscape. A reelected president's second-term agenda was effectively dead on arrival, despite 2012 election results that were weighted blue. Well, how blue? Not only did Democrats add to their majority in the Senate, but Democratic House candidates were popular. If you were to add up all of the votes in all 435 House elections, the Democrats won by 1.4 million votes. It's not a shabby margin. Speaker Boehner would claim on election night that Americans had renewed the GOP's majority, but this was actually the first time in 40 years since the 49-state Nixon landslide of 1972, and just the second time since World War II that the party with the most votes didn't win the majority of the seats. So what happened? We know that ticket splitting has decreased over recent decades as partisanship has hardened, but in 2012, that actually fell to a 92-year low. So it wasn't that people voted for a Democratic president and then for a Republican House as a check on its power. As I looked deeper, I came across two things I'd never heard of before: a political action group called the Republican State Leadership Committee and their plan called Red Map. That strategy is the reason why Republicans held the House in 2012, despite almost 1.5 million fewer votes, and it's the reason why Republicans have a firewall on the House well into the next decade, a firewall impervious to most any political landslide, no matter what you've read the last couple of days. To understand what happened in 2012, we have to back up and think about the elections of 2008 and 2010. 2008 brought Barack Obama a Democratic supermajority in the Senate and a majority in the House. It was the fourth presidential election of five in which the Democrats won the popular vote. Go back and watch the live election coverage of that night, and the smartest minds in the GOP are despairing over demographic changes that could render them a minority party for a generation. On CNN, Wolf Blitzer and John King peered deep into their blue map. They did fancy things with their hands. And found counties that had been reliable for George W. Bush here in Pennsylvania: Bucks, Montgomery, Chester, tipping to the Democrats. The editor of the Conservative National Review simply wonders if all the Republicans had upped and moved to Utah. While they despaired, however, a brilliant Republican strategist named Chris Jankowski, the executive director of the RSLC, had an idea. He realized that 2008 represented a Democratic wave and brought the historic election of an African-American president, but he also realized the truly important election would be held in 2010. That's because the Constitution mandates the redistricting of every state legislative and congressional district every 10 years following the census. Elections in years ending in zero simply mean more than other elections. They can reverberate throughout the rest of the decade. Jankowski's more famous Republican strategies, like the bright lights, big city feel of a presidential campaign, that he had long believed you could get more done for the conservative cause and at a discount price on the state level. His donors might not feel like a kingmaker or a Koch brother by writing a check headed for a candidate in Pennsylvania's 130th, but their money might make more difference. The strategy was so simple and elegant, it's amazing that no one had hit on it in quite this way before. Target state House and Senate races nationwide with the goal of flipping legislative chambers and controlling the redistricting process in as many states as possible, then draw themselves friendly districts that locked in these gains, even in blue and purple states, for the next 10 years. The Republicans would mount their comeback by using the oldest trick in the book, the gerrymander, but in a thoroughly modern and brand new way. This was the greatest political heist in modern American history. Jankowski and the RSLC, helped along by the Citizens United ruling that January, which unleashed anonymous dark money into the system, would spend $30 million on Red Map. In Connecticut, Linda McMahon would squander $100 million on two losing Senate seats. Inject $100,000 by surprise into a state House race, especially if you drop all that money on negative ads in the last month, and you can have a devastatingly effective impact. They spent $1 million on Ohio state House races, flipping the chamber and giving the GOP complete control over the redrawing of 132 legislative districts and 16 congressional seats. Another $1 million in Michigan flipped the House and Senate, bringing complete control of 148 legislative districts and 14 more congressional seats. They spent just under $1 million here in Pennsylvania, delivering veto-proof control over redistricting. Several Democrats here were at ground zero of Red Map, David Kessler in Ole, David Livdansky out west in Elizabeth. They were hit with a deluge of full-color, multi-page negative mailers, slamming them with backing a $600 million Taj Mahal library for Arlen Specter that actually didn't exist. There were similar successful efforts in Wisconsin, North Carolina, Texas, Florida, many other states. And it was announced and planned. Karl Rove lays it out in the Wall Street Journal in March of 2010. He says that the Republicans are going to control redistricting and then Congress in flashing neon lights. Maybe the Democrats don't read the Wall Street Journal. No matter what, this was a catastrophic strategic failure. The essential second part of this is that in 2011, they pressed the advantage. In Ohio, Republican strategists barricade themselves into a suite at the DoubleTree for months. They dub it the bunker. They tell no one where they are. And together with strategists from the Republican National Committee and then-Speaker Boehner's political team, devise new lines based on complicated mathematical algorithms. In Wisconsin, Paul Ryan's pals barricaded themselves in a law firm across from the Capitol, claimed attorney-client privilege for the maps they drew, required even Republican incumbents to sign confidentiality agreements before being shown their new districts. North Carolina, they bring in a master mapmaker named Tom Hofeller, who treats redistricting more seriously than espionage and gives colleagues a presentation warning them not to send public emails, never to even leave your computer visible. Most importantly, don't fire anyone on the staff until you're sure the entire process is done. In Florida, strategists conspired an end run around a new state constitutional amendment mandating nonpartisan redistricting by running a secret shadow redistricting process and funneling maps through phony emails and former interns without their knowledge. So then in 2012, you have the first elections run on these new maps, and you see exactly how effective they are. The maps provide the firewall that keeps Republicans in charge. Here in Pennsylvania, Democratic House candidates receive 100,000 more votes. Democrats take 13 of the 18 seats. 52% of the vote equals 28% of the seats. A Princeton neuroscientist runs the numbers on this and says that formulation of votes and seats would happen naturally one time out of 1,000. The gerrymander of the decade, asked Real Clear Politics. The most gerrymandered map I've seen in the modern history of our state, said a Franklin and Marshall political scientist. The most distorted in the country as far as vote share and seats won, says a Washington University researcher. The lines were crafted so Pennsylvania, blue in every presidential election since 1988, has 12 of your 18 seats that are designed demographically to be more Republican than the rest of the nation. Those seats cannot be won by the other party. You also end up with districts like the 7th, the Donald Duck kicking goofy. So impossible to run in that when I spent a day with a congressional candidate there last summer, we could not hit 3 picnics in 8 hours given the driving time. And she had to use the house.gov website for most people she met to know for sure what district they were in. You see similar numbers in just about every state. In Michigan, House Democrats win 240,000 more votes. Republicans take 9 of the 14 seats. Ohio, Republicans win a supermajority in the state house despite having fewer votes and take 12 of the 16 congressional seats, 75%, despite the votes being split just about evenly. It's the maps that produce exactly the results that the Republicans imagined. Now, gerrymandering goes back to 1790. You can trace it back to the very founding of the Republic, to Massachusetts and Governor Elbridge Gerry, whose party draws lines that look like a salamander, leading a political cartoonist to dub it the gerrymander. Both parties have done it for years. It's been a useful tool of revenge on an enemy. It's been useful for protecting incumbents, even gaining seats here and there that you may not deserve. What's different in 2010 as well is the technology. Map making and the demographic advances by 2010 are so amazing that even redistricting in recent computer era decades, say 1990 or 2000, are practically still horse and buggy era, and you go straight on to the rocket ship in 2010. These districts are built with a program called Maptitude, which comes with all of the census results wired in. So you have all of the demographic and economic data you could imagine. You can add on all sorts of public record data sets, election results, precinct by precinct, sorted down to the very minute block level of local races going back years. Then if you're a political party, you can add on private data sets, magazine subscriptions, cookies from the internet, social media likes and histories. With so much information, mapmakers in 2010 were able to draw precise, perfect boundaries they knew would be reliable partisan performers for the next decade. Perhaps they became too reliable. I'd argue that the Republicans guaranteed themselves control of Congress, but that the leadership generated a Republican caucus they could not control. For example, when Republicans redistricted North Carolina, they took the city of Asheville, a funky college town, which had been represented by a conservative Democrat named Heath Shuler. Probably remember him here from playing quarterback for the Washington Redskins. And they cracked the Democratic vote there in two, divided it into two districts, both won by Republicans, as North Carolina became a state with 13 members of Congress, 10 of them Republicans. Asheville would now be represented by Mark Meadows, a Tea Party Republican who campaigns on the platform of sending President Obama back to Kenya. He was no more enamored with Speaker Boehner. It's Meadows who is part of the Renegade House Freedom Caucus, a group of conservatives pure in their distaste for deal-making, made up entirely of Republicans elected on these new maps this decade, who files the parliamentary move, which leads to Boehner's undoing as Speaker. The establishment falls and fared no better in the presidential campaign this year, as once presumptive nominees by the names of Bush, Christie, Rubio, Kasich, and Walker might tell you. Here's what has happened. We've created 400 of 435 districts where there is no competition outside of the party primary. Members from these districts need only guard their base. Compromise, governing, seeking common ground, all of the things central to the art of politics are the exact things that threaten their livelihoods. These uncompetitive districts have made the government responsive only to the extremes. They are the reason we can't get action on issues where the great center agrees, especially as we saw this week yet again on guns. It is not going to be easy to undo. The system has been knotted up at all different levels, state houses, Congress, state judiciaries, and it may take years and many election cycles for the far-reaching consequences of the 2010 election to be cleared away. The Democrats are trying to run the Republicans' play in 2020, but they will have less money, no element of surprise, and the hardest challenge of all, winning on maps so tilted that they have rigged the game in favor of a minority. We are the only democracy in the world that allows Republicans to choose their own voters. We want our votes to count. We want these elections to matter. When our democratic institutions become separated from the popular will, they cease to be effective, let alone democratic. The entire notion of a house as the mirror of popular views comes deeply into question. The trendy headline this week is that a Clinton landslide and a Trump debacle could tilt the House to the Republicans. One hesitates to call anything out of reach during a campaign season that has upended all forms of conventional wisdom. Nevertheless, this will not happen. But if we're going to have four more months of debating whether the Democrats stand even the most remote possibility of capturing the House, it's important to understand all the recent history which explains why it's a non-starter. Our political conversation around the partisan divide in Congress and how it got this way is too often ahistorical and just plain wrong. Things changed forever after this last census. We have 3 election cycles to fix it, or we live with it for another decade. Thank you. Happy to take any questions, and there are some microphones around the room.
David, the Senate is in play this year, as opposed maybe to the representatives. We're wondering what your recommendation or what your thoughts are on the correction of this process. You've been on the stump for a number of months, et cetera, and we're anxious to hear your thoughts on how you think it can be corrected.
Thank you. It's the essential question, and there aren't good answers. It's been knotted up at so many different levels that the only way to undo it is to mount campaigns that try to tip these legislative chambers across the country in other directions, or in such a way that there's a multiplicity of voices in those rooms. The beauty of what REDMAP does is they target control of states where Republicans can have a veto-proof say over the entire process, and there's no other voice in the room. And you see the kinds of lines that get drawn when nobody has an opinion outside of one side. So the Democrats have to figure out a way to get legislative chambers back, and they have to get a seat at the table when lines are drawn by 2021. I'm not super optimistic that they understand how long of a process this is or how complicated it is to make work. And they announced last year that they were going to run something called Advantage 2020, which would be their redistricting play. The Republicans, and they were going to put $70 million towards it. Republicans came back a week later and said, oh yeah, we're doing REDMAP 2, by the way, and we're going to have $125 for it. So they're going to be spending, and the other beauty of 2010 is that they had that element of surprise, that the Democrats didn't have the vision or imagination to see it coming or read the Wall Street Journal, and as a result, they got routed. It's going to be harder to run that play this time. Whenever you have a referendum that tries to move redistricting away from the politicians and put it back into the hands of either people or nonpartisans, these referendums win. One in Ohio last year. They've won in Florida and Arizona and California. So I mean, red states, blue states, purple states. I think that people have a gut level instinct, no matter what side you're on, that things are broken and dysfunctional and have to be fixed, and that we want the side with the most votes to actually win, and that we want our politics to involve persuasion again, and that they don't right now. So I think a referendum like that is something that could work. Once again, they don't always work. Sometimes it simply throws the partisanship into a different place if the members of these commissions are being appointed by the politicians. You see in Arizona exactly what a mess that can become as well. So it's deeply tricky. The only last hope, quickly I'll say, is if the Supreme Court is able to find some sort of a measure for a partisan gerrymandering. You all had the Veef case here in the last decade. And Justice Kennedy says in that case that he's open to a standard if someone can show it to him. And there's a handful of cases trying to work their way through the system now, attempting to show him what that might look like.
You mentioned Arizona twice, but I thought Arizona could. I wonder if you could give us the details. I thought they've done, maybe my memory's wrong, but I thought they did a fairly admirable job of trying to make this competitive districts. And just as an aside, I don't see what gerrymandering had to do with the vote in the Senate on the four bills that went down on gun control. I mean, that's not gerrymandering. That's just the way the states are drawn.
No,
the Senate
is not gerrymandered. No, okay. But certainly there's a reason why they start those votes in the Senate and don't start them in the House.
Yeah,
you know, whether after Sandy Hook they tried the same move, and you know, you see that now. The beauty of Arizona is that the results were actually pretty good. The state has been more competitive. The districts are more competitive, and the district control of the delegation tends to tip in the direction of the party that is having a good year that year. So you know, in 2008 the Democrats take it over, and in 2010 the Republicans take it back, which is basically as it should be. The problem with the Arizona process is you've got a 5-person commission, 4 of whom are appointed by the politicians, 2 from both sides, and then you have an independent commissioner who is selected through the state appellate court process. And so you end up with 2 hardcore partisans of both parties, and then they try to sway a supposedly independent commissioner who this last time around the Republicans in the state are convinced was a Trojan horse for the Democrats and who pushed the maps in their direction. And so when I went to Arizona and talked to people, they all said, everybody said, well, the Democrats outplayed us last time by getting their person in the chairman seat by gaming the appellate court process. So you can be sure that in 5 years, that's what we'll be trying to do. And it just moves the process sort of deeper into the shadows. There are states that have, you know, stronger commissions and commissions where they're not quite as susceptible to partisan influence.
How much do you think
You know, I don't know the specifics of all of those Virginia districts, but certainly, Virginia is among the states in which Republicans have certainly tried to play to their advantages. It could well be that Cantor overreached and thought that his seat was so safe that he gave up Republican votes to try to make neighboring districts more Republican. But I mean, I think he got overrun by a Tea Party wave and a talk radio wave and, you know, a lot of things. It was certainly a warning call to the other Republicans, however, that your base is the one thing that can do you in, and it doesn't matter if you're a majority leader or not. You upset the base at your own peril.
Two questions. One, isn't there a tendency for Democrats to be concentrated in the urban areas heavily? Like in Philadelphia, the Republican Party is down to less than 10% of the vote, maybe 7%. That's one question. Mm-hmm. Isn't there a natural tendency for the big metropolitan districts to be Democrat, and that creates an imbalance? But the second question is, aren't most of the states the model that you suggested with 2 Republicans and 2 Democrats and supposedly an independent commissioner? So why wouldn't that result in a more fair drawing of lines?
Sure. What you're referring to is commonly called the Big Sort theory, after the book The Big Sort, that Democrats are concentrated in cities, Republicans in other areas, and as a result, what you see is that we have naturally sorted ourselves. I think the best response to that in some ways is to look at what's happened here in Pennsylvania. In 2008, Obama wins the state, and House Democrats get more votes than House Republicans. Similar margins in 2012. Obama wins the state by about the same amount, and House Democrats get more votes by about a similar amount over Republicans. In 2008, those results led to 12 seats for the Democrats. In 2012, it leads to 5. So is it possible that all of the Democrats in the state sorted themselves into Pittsburgh and Pennsylvania? I suppose it's possible. I think a better answer is what changed during that time was the nature of the lines and where they were. You can draw these lines any which way. You can draw lines that, you know, and what happened here was that as many Democrats as possible were packed into 5 districts while the other 13 were handed over at different numbers. I think it was something like, I think that the 5 Democrats won with about 70% of the vote and the 13 Republicans won between 57 and 61 or something like that. So it's super artful and sophisticated work. Congressman, I'm going to pronounce his name wrong, who was sent off today, Ashaka Fatah, won with the biggest margin of any politician in the country back in 2012. So do all of those votes need to be in that district, or could they have been sorted in some other way? I'd suggest that the lines have a pretty heavy influence there. Your other question on independent commissions. There are a handful of states that use independent commissions or some variation thereof. As of right now, there's 435 seats. You need 218 for control. Republicans right now have complete control over the drawing of 193 of those seats. Democrats have complete control over the drawing of 44 of them, and I believe independent commissions have about 100, and then there's about 88 states that are where it's split, and both people have a seat at the table. So, I mean, 193 to 44 is a pretty good advantage to have when you're trying to get to 218. And most of the states under, because California has a commission, the commission model is probably weighted pretty heavily in that direction, you know, just with the number of seats they have. There are states that do it really well and really fairly. I think Iowa is probably the best example of that. And then there's states where a commission simply makes it politics by another means. I think that's the history of just about any reform is, you know, whether you're talking about campaign finance or anything else, that you give it enough time and the people who have an agenda, you know, find a way around it and find the loophole and figure out how to exploit it.
Mr. Daley, could you just briefly outline how the Constitution originally required the districting within the states or the colonies? Original states?
You know, I am not a constitutional scholar, so I probably would struggle to do that exactly. But the goal here has always been that, you know, seats have to be apportioned, you know, based on population. And it's certainly changed over the years, and people move and people die, and more people are given the vote, and so that the goal has always been to have, you know, districts that are fair and equitable, and to be, you know, looking at the apportionment of it every 10 years. And there's been an entire series of court cases that have kind of built us here. Largely through Supreme Court cases that have mandated a racial balance and have mandated population equity and have set up the examples of the formulas based on how states gain and lose seats. I'm not sure anything remedies it other than trying to find a more radical reform that tries to kickstart this into a new decade and a new time. There are some really interesting ideas around, say, multi-member districts or instant runoff voting, things that can try and take things back from the extremes and try and elect a different kind of candidate.
This maybe relates to that last question. It would seem like there should be some common sense definition that would be could apply to a fair district. Five picnics in one day, with squares of equal size. And is it that it just has to work its way through the Supreme Court? And would another two Supreme Court justices that are interested in this, would that be the easy solution?
It could very well be. It could very well be. There's a case making its way through Wisconsin right now that is especially trying to, it's aimed square at Kennedy. It's just saying, this is your model. And they call it the efficiency gap. And essentially it's a measurement of wasted votes, and that they're trying to align if both parties in a state have an equal number of wasted votes, you can try and devise a formula that shows what would happen if the lines were actually fair. And then if the results fall outside of that, you have a problem. If it's inside, you're okay. If it falls outside of that, the courts have to take another look at it. But it's a complicated process, and they haven't found anything that they like yet.
This is fascinating and depressing. You talked a little about referendums. I'm wondering if you can talk a little about whether or not the Republicans are feeling the backlash of unintended consequences, and if so, whether or not that might make a difference how they approach the 2020 redistricting.
I think they very much are facing unintended consequences. You see it first when Eric Cantor loses his seat. You see it next when John Boehner has to step down as Speaker. And you certainly see it this year. And they've created the conditions under which Donald Trump could, waltz in and steal their party and not have much to say about it. Will this affect what they do in 2020? I doubt it. They've already announced that they're going to go after Colorado and New Mexico and a bunch of the western states that they think they can, flip and try to realign. You get a very different kind of representative through this. I don't know if the Democrats take back Congress in 2012 under different maps, but it would have been closer. And when things are closer, people have more reason to talk to each other. And when things are closer, districts get represented by different kinds of people. And that changes the tenor and tone of everything. If it had been, 221, 214, that's very different than the swing that they have now, which is as big as it's ever been in 100 years. But I don't know how I'm not convinced that they will necessarily learn from this. I think they will probably keep on this path.
It sounds like in 2020 that from what you're saying, the redistricting is going to make things even more polarized between Democrats and Republicans. Is there any chance that in 2020, or would we have to look even further out for there to be the possibility of a multi-party system, which might allow for more dialogue in between representatives? And I mean, what do you think about that? Do you think there's a reasonable timeline that could start now? Maybe not in this election cycle, but down the road.
I would love to see that opened up. It just takes tremendous infrastructure and ballot access, and it is a really long, hard process to build a party. And Ross Perot wins 18% in 1992, gets that ballot access and the matching funds that go along with it. That party hasn't existed for 15 years. These things get built fast and they go away fast. Could it be that, I mean, you could imagine a system in which the Republican Party splits over Donald Trump, conceivably, in which some of the more sort of Wall Street establishment voices go off in another direction and they let the kind of more nationalistic voices within the party go their own way. And one could certainly look at the Democrats and say that they're not far from a civil war of their own on that side. Hillary Clinton had every advantage in this last election, and she still had to hold on to beat a 74-year-old socialist from Vermont. That suggests that the Democrats are not necessarily immune to the same kind of outrage and anger, but a multi-party system takes a lot of time, and can you build that infrastructure up between now and 2020 to the tune of winning enough seats in local races to gain a seat at the table in redistricting? I doubt it.
How did the states that have independent commissions, how did that get initiated? Did they wait for a 10-year cycle, or did they have some kind of a grassroots movement? How did it get started?
You know, a lot of it is, a lot of those are through referendums. Or they've been in place for many years because the politicians made agreements with each other, recognizing that sometimes you're going to win, sometimes we're going to win, and we all want a seat at the table, so let's figure out how to do this. So you have a state like New Jersey, which has a commission that includes politicians and representatives of the political community, but is chaired by an academic. That's one pretty effective approach. You have a state like Iowa, where the politicians actually got tired of having their districts hauled into court, and they said, we're going to figure out how to take the politics out of this, and they handed it over to nonpartisan bureaucrats, and they all actually trust the nonpartisan bureaucrats. It's a pretty serious political state. They beat each other's brains out on lots and lots of issues. But they trust that the people who are drawing the lines don't have their thumb on the scale. And that's a pretty remarkable culture to have. But the citizens of those states also take these processes really seriously. You talk to folks in Iowa, and they're proud of the fact that they've got, you know, nonpartisan redistricting. It does seem like these districts are the building blocks of everything we have. And when we don't take seriously the way that these lines are drawn, we get the kind of politics we see.
Hi, I'm involved with an organization called Fair Districts PA, and we are trying to establish an independent commission in Pennsylvania, which seems to be the baseline that all of us should be working towards. If anybody wants information about it, it's fairdistrictspa.com. But my question is there sort of a national movement in that direction? Are there other groups like ours that are trying to deal with their state legislative control over their districts?
There seem to be. I've noticed some following me on Twitter in the last week, so I think they may be out there. Yeah, I think that it's possible that this could build into a real movement. There are, whenever a state pulls this off, it tends to be around Common Cause or the League of Women Voters and good government groups who want work to get done. I mean, in Arizona, there were a lot of Republicans involved who were really tired of seeing imbalanced districts, who were giving them a choice of crazy or crazier, and the state's losing Super Bowls and getting rid of Martin Luther King holidays as a result. It was bad for business. When you start doing things that are bad for business, the Republican establishment gets a little angry at you, and they say, let's find another way here. So I think that things have gotten so extreme and that the technology makes it so easy to make these districts so safe and secure that perhaps we are understanding that this is not just politics as usual anymore. This is a real crisis of democracy.
I was wondering if there was any pushback while you were doing the research for the work, anybody who seemed to be concealing anything or, any chicanery?
I was actually stunned at how open and how proud the Republicans who did this were and how willing they were to talk. I think they also realized they pulled off the political heist of the century, and they are pretty proud of the work that was done. For $30 million, they, locked in control of the House for a decade, built themselves a firewall, saw the impact and results of it right away in 2012. I think they see it as we did our jobs, and the Democrats could have done the same thing if they'd thought of it, and it's not like we kept it secret and didn't tell them what we were doing, and they just didn't figure it out or respond. And it's funny. I never felt as if any of it was being hidden. The other beauty, now what's hidden and what had to be dug out were the emails and the court transcripts and kind of a lot of the trail of this that follows in Wisconsin, in Florida, in Ohio. But Republican mapmakers were perfectly willing to sit down and talk to me. I mean, I met in Michigan with a whole bunch of them who drew some of the craziest maps in the country, and not a lot that they don't get a lot of media requests. So when someone calls and says, "Tell me about what you do," they tend to answer.
Welcome to Philadelphia first.
Thank you.
Looking back on the Voting Rights Act,
it's a great question.
You see that would have any chance of helping to mount any sort of challenge to this sort of political action in the state legislatures? Because one of the things I think I've heard from Texas is not what the intent was, but what the result was of their redistricting, and that being used as a basis for basically sending their redistricting plan back to the drawing board.
The Voting Rights Act has got a really complicated history in redistricting. I mean, if you look at what happened in the South in the 1990s, you've got something called the Unholy Alliance, as it's been dubbed. It's African-American Democrats in the South working together with Republicans who wanted to win more seats. And as a result, the Democrats begin electing more African-Americans to Congress than they had really ever. But Republicans were able to pack all the Democrats into those seats and flip the rest of those states. And that really is, part one of how the Republicans took over Congress, with this book being part two. And It was a very strategic, intent-driven plan. And you can see both sides of it, you know? I mean, I'm sure that if you're a black Democrat in the South, you are probably pretty frustrated with being taken for granted and being represented by white Democrats when you are the biggest element of the coalition. On the other hand, what the Republicans did, and it's a really amazing story. I mean Lee Atwater, who's as responsible for the Solid South and for the state of our racial politics as anybody, becomes chairman of the Republican National Committee after he elects George Bush off the Willie Horton ad in 1988, and he calls in Ben Ginsburg, his new counsel, on the first day, and he says, "Ben, we're going to do something about redistricting." And Atwater comes from South Carolina, so he knows exactly where he's going to do it. And what they come up with is a plan to work together with African American Democrats in the South to make it a win-win for both of them, but a loss for the Democratic Party. A journalist asks Ginsburg if they'd had a name for this plan when they were working on it, you know, not long after it helps elect Newt Gingrich in 94. And Ginsburg thinks about it for a second, and he said, "We didn't, but if we had, we would have called it Project Ratfuck." So but that's the title, and I've come full circle. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.